Let's find out why we get lost. It may seem obvious, but it's common. Professor Kenneth Hill is a psychologist at St. Mary's University in Nova Scotia. He's written some of the definitive treatises on this. His advice has been sought around the world, including from New Zealand, and he's also highly experienced himself on search and rescue teams in an area that was long known as the world capital of missing persons. Professor Ken Hill, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Getting lost is quite topical down here. Did you read about the young couple lost in the New Zealand bush?
Yes, I did. That was a very interesting story, indeed.
And the length of time, too, because that kind of matches up with some famous North American cases in terms of how long you can survive in the bush as well.
Yeah, it does, especially when you have two people together like that. The odds are much better than when somebody's alone.
It's, of course, a terrible experience. I'm sure we've all been lost. Have you ever been lost?
Yes, I have, when I was a boy.
Same, but in an urban setting. How about in the outdoors?
No, I was lost in the outdoors, in the woods near Los Angeles. At that time, it was quite a wilderness, and it's called Topanga Canyon. I was lost all day, and finally my father ended up finding me.
Can you remember any of the emotional aspects of that, how you felt?
Well, I was scared, remember that, and I just kept moving, hoping, you know, to find something, find my way out or whatever, and saw a few animals, saw a bobcat and whatever, and that just scared me all the more.
Do you reckon that has in part led you to what you do, because you're a real authority on being lost?
Oh, it certainly has. Especially when a child is lost, I feel very, very bad for them. And I guess like anybody who's lost a child in the woods or is looking for a child, it's just all the much more important, you know, do your best to have a safe ending.
I'm assuming that bobcat paid no attention to you, or did it?
I think he was more afraid of me than I was of him. Yeah.
Children getting lost. Wired magazine, I was reading, says during the 18th and 19th centuries, getting lost was one of the most common causes of death among the children of European settlers in North America.
I'm not surprised. Yeah.
Does that still happen to a reasonable degree, kids getting lost?
It's still fairly common. Of course, a lot of the forested areas around cities and suburbs are being developed. So a lot of places are finding fewer and fewer of those kinds of searches. Still very common in parks. Children will walk away from a camp or they'll follow a dog or follow an animal. And they don't have to go very far before, you know, the parents are doing something, cooking or whatever, talking, and they look around and Johnny's not anywhere around.
You've searched for people. You've looked at hundreds and hundreds of cases, and you live in a big place which is 80% forest still. It was called the lost person capital of North America, wasn't it?
It used to be called that, yes. A lot of parents underestimate, you know, how easy it is for a child to wander off and get lost. We just had a search last month where they're still looking for the lad. He walked off in his backyard, and his grandmother was looking the wrong way, and he was gone, and they still haven't found him. They suspect he may have fallen into a river or a creek or something there. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it was very tragic, very tragic, yes.
What do people who are lost do? They don't stay put, do they?
If they stay put, they don't stay lost very long. We always used to say, you know, we always find clues about the person before we find the person himself or herself. There's a tendency, you know, when you're afraid, you just, the fight or flight syndrome, you just want to keep moving. You just want to run, or you want to find the right place. You want to get back to where you're safe. And just sitting there waiting for someone to find you, in some places that might not be a realistic kind of option. You might be so far away from, you know, search and rescue teams that there's no way that staying in one place is going to be very functional. But for the most part, most people who get lost tend to move, and they tend to move away, further away from the point where they were last seen. So it's very common for searchers to find clues about the, you know, footprints and clothing and whatever before they actually catch up with the lost person.
Yeah, the finding clues before you find the person is a persuasive argument for staying put. Although in a couple of famous cases, people have stayed put, as you refer to, and cruelly, sadly, haven't been found too.
That's right. It's, the environment is everything.
So the first thing you should do when you find yourself lost is probably what? Take time out. Don't keep moving. Sit down and have a good think.
That's exactly right. How did I get into the situation? What you need to do is calm yourself down, because when you're excited, when you're upset, when you're afraid, then you're not going to do your best thinking. Just think about what you have to do to get out of the situation, and then give yourself a reasonable amount of time to find your way out, find your way to safety. And after a while, if that's not working, you need to, especially if it's getting dark, you need to do something to take care of yourself and protect yourself from the weather and whatever else, you know, can be threatening, and just stay there.
Why do we walk in circles, Ken? Why can't we walk in a straight line?
Well, first of all, there are a lot of times I think that's overstressed. People don't necessarily walk in circles when they get lost. When it does happen, it's because for a number of things. It could be the environment is channeling you in a certain direction. It could be a physical thing. It could be if your right leg is stronger than your left leg or vice versa, then that may give you a bias that will tend to make you, when you think you're walking straight, and I've experienced this in training, you think you're walking straight, and in fact, you end up quite a bit off the mark. And you could, if you walk far enough, it could end up to where you, back to where you started.
Yeah, people have come up with all sorts of fancy brain analysis suggestions for why we walk in circles, but you're thinking they maybe overthink it, that there are all sorts of decent reasons.
Yes, people who have no plan, no strategy. I did a long-term research on this. People who are not familiar with the woods, who are afraid of the woods, afraid of getting lost, tend to act much differently than people who feel comfortable in the forest.
We're talking with Professor Kenneth Hill. Ken, you know an awful lot about this subject, and I have read that you say all you need to know about lost people is their age, their outdoor activity, and you can calculate how far they're likely to travel and where you should go looking?
Well, there's more, yes. But that's a starting point. Certainly their age is very important, but their physical ability, their experience in the woods, whether they're alone or with somebody else, all kinds of variables come into play. The environment itself, of course, is an important one. As a rule, people tend to travel farther than, at least historically, than search and rescue people or parents or other or police would have thought that they could have gone.
Is there a common denominator psychologically? When you have met some of these people afterwards, what have you concluded?
I don't know about a common denominator, but I've talked to quite a few who really thought that they were going to die. And in fact, one woman I interviewed said she had sat down and started to make out her will, her last letter to her family. So the fear is a common denominator. And I think even some of the more experienced outdoors people I've met were more fearful, had been more afraid than they were willing to admit. Deer hunters, for example, will, you know, travel around. I've followed them, actually, quite interesting. And looking for signs, they're not really keeping track of where they are. But the better hunters, the ones less likely to get lost, in addition to having a good sense of direction, will also know how to use their compass. They're always keeping track of what direction they're going, what direction is the safe way out. But hunting by its nature is puts you at risk for getting lost, because you're really not thinking. If you're looking for sign, you're really not thinking necessarily about where you are and what you're going to do. You're more interested, you know, your emotions are all about finding that deer or finding whatever game you're looking for. Mm. Whereas hikers are on a trail and anglers are going to their favorite lake and that sort of thing. We tend to see fewer of those than we do hunters, even though many people participate in those other activities.
It's interesting what you said about people giving up. you know, maybe starting to try and write their last will and testament. There was a famous case of a woman on the Appalachian Trail who started doing that, you know, writing to her husband and children 4 days into being lost. And she lived another, or she lived 19 days in total. So there's some kind of emotion that overtakes people, a sense of hopelessness quite early on.
Yes. Well, one day being lost is like a week to the person. I mean, you know, you're not sleeping at night. You know, time is experienced differently when you're lost. So an hour may seem like a day. And so, you know, there's a point at which you say, this is pointless. I'm weak. I'm starving. I'm thirsty. I don't know where the heck I am. And this hopelessness starts to set in. I've seen it.
Yeah, I'm sure you've seen it.
Yeah.
Lots of times. And you would have had some very sad experiences out there, as well as some happy ones, some joyous ones.
That's true.
Can you, for example, pick, I'll ask you about a lucky one first. Is there one or a group of them that stand out in your head from your experience?
A lucky one. A five-year-old boy followed a deer into the woods, became lost, and we searched in the worst kind of weather in Nova Scotia, just dreary snow and cold temperatures and freezing rain for 5 days, and we had no idea that he was going to make it. But what he had done is he crawled into a hole, and he stayed there the whole time. And when the weather let up, he got out and walked out into the road and hailed a car that was passing by and said, you know, I want my mommy. The ladies driving the car were delivering sandwiches to the people at the search site. So so they were technically part of the search and rescue group. So we got credit for that, although I wasn't too proud. Anyway,
why do you like being involved in looking for people who get lost and researching people who get lost? Partly, as we've agreed, it's your early experience, but there it must be emotionally compelling for you in some way.
Oh, yes, it is. Yeah, it's a number of reasons. You know, I think a lot of search and rescue volunteers especially will recognize this. It's a feeling that, you know, you can save a life and you're working in an environment that you love, and there's something you can actually do to make a difference. The training that happens, people love the training. They love using, the dog handlers love using their dogs, and it just all comes together. And it's a very, you know, it's a community thing too, because search and rescue teams tend to be very much socially connected with each other and that sort of thing. And it's very gratifying. And you have some good search and rescue teams in New Zealand too.
But at the same time, a lot of your cases would be very sad, wouldn't they?
Oh, of course. And every time we have a search, you know, that's unsuccessful or the death is involved, and the team has to be involved in what happens, you know, the evacuation, that sort of thing. We tend to lose a few members. And I can understand why. They just don't want to have that. They didn't really sign up for that, even though they may have been training and very much involved, but then they've got to evacuate, a body or whatever, or even worse, in some cases, they tend to lose their interest. They just don't want to experience that again. I've got their little, like PTSD. In fact, it can be quite stressful.
Yeah. What about the advice we heard when we were all younger, or at least I did when I was younger? You know, either find high ground to have a look or follow a stream down to where it joins a river, that kind of traditional advice. What do you think?
Finding high ground is best, is what the most experienced and skillful lost hunters do in my research. They'll climb a tree or go up a hill and try to see something that looks familiar in the distance. The part about follow a stream to civilization, if you do that in Nova Scotia, you're just going to end up in some isolated swamp someplace, more than likely than not. So it's a bit of woods wisdom that you hear around the campfire that gets people, sometimes, more often than not, gets people into trouble.
Do you subscribe to the view that some people have no sense of direction, whereas others can locate themselves spatially without even having to think about it?
Absolutely. Yeah. And people are pretty good at accurately reporting their own sense of direction. Mine's kind of low, so I'm around 2 or 3 on a scale of 7. people I work with in search and rescue, a lot of them have extremely high sense of direction. Unfortunately, I don't have that ability. So I've always got a couple of compasses and a GPS with me.
Okay, so yeah, that's really interesting. You have to work at it. Because some people, you know, we're often told, you know, proceed, even when we're driving by GPS, you know, head west or proceed north. And a lot of people have no idea what that is.
That's true.
What is your take on the way we use or overuse GPS now, for example, in cities? Do you think we're losing the ability to navigate?
I don't think that many people would have an ability to navigate anyway without GPS. We train our searchers to rely more on map and compass than electronics. But more often than not, we have our searchers in the field have a GPS, because we've had many cases where search teams got turned around a bit or had to radio in, you know, to get a bead on their location. It's not a good idea to rely on any one single navigation aid.
No, but it isn't turning us into a race of people who just are wandering blindly now, whereas once we perhaps had a better instinct about where to go.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And there's some interesting research on Inuit or so-called Eskimo wayfinders, navigators, who've relying more and more on GPS. And they're losing the tribal wisdom of how to find your way around. It's true. It is happening. GPS has a dark side to it. You know, people rely too much on it sometimes and not enough on how to read a map and how to use a compass.
We've heard your wisdom this morning, and it's great wisdom, but having acquired it, you still retain a fascination with this. You've done that for many, many years. It keeps you interested, people being lost. Yeah. Why is that?
Oh, I don't know. It just comes natural to me. My first involvement was in 1986, a very unfortunate and tragic search for an eight-year-old boy in Nova Scotia. And I got involved in that because I was basically my work is in child development. And the police asked me for some advice on how to find a boy, and I went down there, and there were about 5,000 people at the search base, and the RCMP Mountie took me to the map, and he said, "Okay, now tell me where we should be looking for this kid." And I didn't have any idea about where to start, so I just joined the search team and spent the rest of the week following around, looking in the woods, and searching and doing grid searches and all sorts of things, and turned out the boy had died of hypothermia. But that stayed with me all these years, and it's something you want to do everything you can to prevent that happening
again. So it's interesting how it's not just academic for you, it's deeply personal, and also I imagine in some sense rewarding as well as highly interesting. It's been deep down rewarding for you.
Oh, extremely rewarding. Oh, there's no feeling like, rescuing somebody who really needed you to come in there and get them. They just weren't going to make it out themselves. And that's seen that in children and adolescents and, hunters, hikers, blueberry pickers, anglers, whatever. There's no feeling like that. And you just feel ecstatic about it. It's very rewarding.
Very good to talk with you. And thanks for your expertise this morning.
My pleasure.
Professor Kenneth Hill.